Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. In 1986, Dennis Hopper appeared on Letterman. They start out by discussing Frank Booth, his character in Blue Velvet, and Letterman says, "Was that, and I don't mean offense by this, as peculiar a character as you've ever portrayed?" Hopper thinks about it for a moment and nods gently and mumbles, "Yeah, probably," and the audience roars with laughter. And then he says, "Then there was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 that I just did. That was pretty weird, too." The audience laughs again. River's Edge is strange, too. I must say, I do strange parts. What I love about this interview is not only is he very aware of how odd his prolific career has been, but also he's on Letterman promoting three, count them, three iconic movies at the same time. The one he appears to be most proud of is River's Edge, which we talk about on the TV show. And if you haven't seen it, it's amazing. In total, Dennis Hopper was in six movies in 1986, including Hoosiers and a Star Trek made-for-TV movie. Really. But before we get into that, Cam, let's go into the history of an actor whose work spans the history of almost Hollywood itself.
He's in Rebel Without a Cause, right? As a background.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was like, he's in two James Dean movies.
Oh, East of, is it East of Eden, the other one?
I think he's in...
Giant. Okay.
He's Giant.
In, yeah, he's one of the... That's right. He's one of the ranch hands.
He's the son of the oil guy.
And he talked about James Dean till the day he died. Like, they were, it was a big
thing.
They were, like, he
only knew him right before he died, but they were tight buddies. I mean, they were both, so to start out the various movements he was involved in, he was one of the first big people out of the Actors Studio with James Dean. So he was, like, Lee Strasberg, kind of method acting. He was one of the early ones, which partially, I think, is why he's known for being a maniac, because he's an early method actor. Worth saying, because I will circle back to it, he was in a lot of Westerns. That was very big for him in the 50s and 60s, where he met Harry Dean Stanton, who will come up again later. He had some parts. 60s for him is pretty good, but obviously Easy Rider is the huge thing. He works with Roger Corman. He manages to produce this script. Everybody's really into it. He makes Easy Rider, gets the Oscar nomination. From then, he, you know, kicks off New Hollywood, arguably, but also is kind of cursed with a extreme blank check. Being the first New Hollywood guy, he's also like the first flame out with the last movie, his follow-up, where he goes to South America and kind of loses his mind making hippie movies. The interesting thing is he never fully ruins his career, I don't think. The last movie kind of shakes it up, but before the end of the decade, he's still in a bunch of big movies. And he admits in that 86 interview, which is great, just look for it on YouTube, he talks about that essentially his process was drugs and alcohol. Like, he obviously integrated it well, you know? Like, people knew, and I think Coppola he worked with a lot, so Coppola... You know, a lot of the New Hollywood guys knew how to work with somebody who incorporated drugs and alcohol. I mean, you can find these wild stories. There's a great story about Willie Nelson bailing him out of jail because he was in, like, Tulsa and he took 100 tabs of acid or something.
Oh, my God.
And Willie Nelson knew him well enough to be like, I'm going to take
Dennis
him.
Dennis Hopper is one of those people where you're like, how did technically old age take you? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's wild.
I mean, he died still fairly young, but he's a fascinating guy because he also, like, there's a total sidebar, but he was very good at speculating art. He has a fascinating art collection. Like, he had Basquiat's when Basquiat
was a photographer during this time too, so he's also photographing the artistic scene in New York,
you can
in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, and LA. Yeah. Like he has the fabulous photos of Jane Fonda that just came up on her birthday. Oh, wow. That yeah, you can just look up just about any celebrity, and yeah, he seemed like he was a cool hang as well. As much as he sometimes seems like a nightmare. So also along the way, it's worth saying that he also met Kit Carson, who will come up again. Anyway, so he hits the 80s. I think he's struggling a lot personally, and he in 1983 goes to rehab. Especially for alcohol, weirdly. Like, I think you kind of think of him as a cocaine guy, but it seems like he was just drinking a lot.
In that Letterman interview, he specifies what he's drinking, doesn't he? Like, it's something like,
You can find various lists, and it's wild. The drugs, you're like, oh, that's pretty bad. And then you hear the alcohol that went with the drugs, and you're like,
he had,
oh,
like,
boy.
A fine chemical balance, though. He was like, hey, I take the uppers here, and then the downers happen. It's like the same as Hunter S. Thompson, who had, like, his schedule, right? This is how I keep
totally,
it balanced.
Totally.
It's very Burning Man.
Yes. And I think, like, the thing is I think he was a fairly high-functioning addict. So he has the problem of a high-functioning addict that when he comes out of rehab, he's very unsure of himself and if his artistic process will continue. So that's around 1984. There is actually, apparently, the big thing that kind of sets off this bunch of roles is that him and Harry Dean Stanton are both up for Pretty in Pink. And Harry Dean Stanton gets it. And then Harry Dean Stanton is like, okay, I got to help my friend. He's just out of rehab. So he is offered two big roles, one of which is River's Edge, which we talk about, and one of which is Blue Velvet. And he thinks he's not right for both of them, and he suggests both of them to Dennis Hopper. Also, on top of that, Kit Carson is writing Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and essentially writes it for Dennis Hopper, another person who is his friend. And then also on top of that, he gets the role that is essentially what his life is in Hoosiers, where it is about an alcoholic learning to kind of function and rejoin society and rejoin what he's great at, which is coaching basketball. So that
and
is
he's
kind
nominated
of,
for an Oscar.
It's his only he's just nominated.
Okay.
But it's his only acting nomination. So
that's actually wild.
Yeah. So that's Hollywood, kind of like mainstream Hollywood, also saying good. But obviously the biggest of these is probably Blue Velvet.
You know, if you have a chance, and it's only really recently being reassessed, Dennis Hopper's directing career post the last movie, post Easy Rider, if you look into the 80s and 90s, which I know you and I discuss quite a bit, Cam, like these kind of erotic thrillers. There's one with Jodie Foster. I can't remember its name. They are so fucking good. They were probably completely panned at the time. But watching them today, they're like just iconic erotic thrillers. And I know they're kind of happening in conjunction with this period in his life.
I really miss the erotic thriller as a genre. Can we get those back, please?
They're kind of, it's Netflix has realized that. Are they? Thing. Okay. And I will also say that if people want more kind of about the meltdown era, you can watch Kit Carson's documentary, The American Dreamer. It's kind of been, I think it's been remastered and stuff lately. It's about shooting the last movie and the post-production. It's him at his wildest.
Well, I mean, Dennis Hopper, as we said, never really went away. He just kind of went in and out of fashion. And the same can sort of be said for the director of our next film, whose film was a comeback of sort after a major public disaster. We're talking about David Lynch. The idea for Blue Velvet was one that had been percolating in his famous weather enthusiast brain for a while since about the early 70s. It started with the title and the knowledge that the movie should have the same feel as the song. And then after the release of 1980's The Elephant Man came the opportunity to pitch to producer Richard Roth. Roth didn't like the script Lynch brought with him, but he asked him what other ideas he had. So he said, I told him I had always wanted to sneak into a girl's room to watch her into the night and that maybe at one point or another I would see something that would be a clue to a murder mystery. That's also his entire career, if we can just say. Then came the image of the severed ear in the field. And Lynch said to the New York Times in an 86 interview, I don't know why it had to be an ear, except that it needed to be an opening of a part of the body, a hole into something else. The ear sits on the head and goes right into the mind, so it felt perfect. It makes sense to me.
Well, it had to be also something that you can sever and not kill the person, because they need to keep the guy who belongs to the ear alive for enough of the movie to make sense. Does that make sense? Like, cutting off a hand or a limb is hard.
Could be a nose.
Could have done a finger.
Could be a nose.
Yeah. Sure. Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Let's not get into this.
Sure. But then right after The Elephant Man and all that success came the fiasco that was Dune. And Lynch knew that he had to get back to making the kinds of movies he was good at on his own terms. And thus, it was time for Blue Velvet in all its crooning, huffing, and taxidermied Robin glory. Alicia, Blue Velvet, how do you feel about this one?
I mean, I remember watching this as a kid and knowing I was watching something great, but being very angry the whole time because it's such an assault. It's an assault that, you know, I now really treasure. It's really weird to say, but God, this is a masterpiece. This might be like one of the certified masterpieces we've ever discussed on this podcast. Just for those listeners who need a bit of a plot summary, a young man played by Kyle MacLachlan's father is in the hospital with a heart attack or something like that. And so he comes home to Lumberton, North Carolina, which is really Wilmington, North Carolina. Obviously, Lumberton is lumber's a huge fascination for David Lynch because his father was a research scientist for the Department of Agriculture in Washington. So he grew up around a lot of like lumberjacks and lumber researchers and trees. And so that all begins to make sense. Kyle MacLachlan's character finds, as we've mentioned, a severed ear in the field. He takes it to the town's police detective who, you know, kind of doesn't know what to make of it. He reconnects with the detective's daughter, who's played by Laura Dern, and probably, I mean, Laura Dern had done Smooth Talk the year before, but this is really her like star-making turn in Blue Velvet. She was 19 at the time. And I think they'd gone to the same high school. They kind of take it upon themselves to solve the mystery of whose ear is this. And they trace the ear somehow to Dorothy Valens, who is played by Isabella Rossellini. And we'll talk a lot about Isabella Rossellini, both her character and as an iconic figure in a bit. But she's a lounge singer. This is why the film is called Blue Velvet. She sings the song Blue Velvet nightly. And they find out she's kind of in this criminal ring with Frank Booth at the head of it, played by Dennis Hopper, who is holding her husband and son hostage because he is fetishistically obsessed with her and makes her do what his at his will, sexually and otherwise, based on holding these two people hostage. And it gets darker and darker from there. Like, really.
It's brutal. I think it is the most coherent of his incoherent films. Like, you think about something that Lost Highway would come later, and like that's all full of very similar imagery and like people playing multiple people and zooming through different identities. And this, I think, is the one that is the clearest to follow, even though it's still very image-based and unusual.
I think coming off of Dune, which we've already mentioned, listeners can research that themselves, it was a total disaster. Coming off of Dune, to me, this film is very much a return to the Eraserhead mode of filmmaking. Eraserhead took Lynch years and years to make and then is released in 1977 as like the midnight film of that year. And it plays for years and really is what leads him to get Elephant Man after he was recommended upon some producer. I can't remember who it is. Not Mel Brooks, because Mel Brooks saw it later. But this is really, you're right, it is coherent. It's incoherent, though, in how fucking dark it is. It still has the very typical montages you expect from Lynch in Twin Peaks, which would come much later, not much later, a few years later, where you're getting, you know, in this case, you're getting a lot of like substrata under a lawn, like many references to bugs in this film. There's so much references to steel, even though Lumberton's obviously a town known for its lumber products, in case you were wondering. I love the radio station refers to Lumberton as the town where people really know how much wood a woodchuck chucks. Like, that's actually a really good description, I think, of this town.
Lumberton, USA. At the sound of the falling tree, it's 1:30. And this is the mighty voice of Lumberton, the town where people really know how much wood a woodchuck chucks.
Where everything, it's a very white town, it's very working class, but upper middle class. And then you're really seeing just how depraved, how much of a subculture of depravity and crime and violence and sexual violence exists after dark in this town where there's lemonade and white picket fences and beautiful roses. It doesn't matter. It's all still there.
Totally. There's an interview I read once with Wendy Roby, who played Nadine on Twin Peaks, where she talked
Nadine.
About.
I'm sorry, I
love her.
I get distracted. Nadine.
I know. Nadine. I know. But she says that that Lynch is obsessed with broken beauty. And I think this is, I mean, that's the best summation of his career I think I've ever heard. And it is especially accurate for this film, is like everything is beautiful on the surface and then totally cracked in a nightmare underneath. Same with watching the character of Isabella Rossellini is like just covered in, I mean, she's broken on the inside and at times she's broken on the outside from how much she's being beaten up.
It's aesthetic of broken glamour too. Because this is a woman who hadn't acted much. For those don't know, she's the daughter of Roberto Rossellini and Ingrid Bergman, but she was a very respected model and like had a lot of beauty campaigns that 100% dropped her after seeing the preview screening of this film. She lost her modeling career almost entirely because of Blue Velvet. Such a beautiful, patrician, stunning woman that Lynch kind of makes her glamour grotesque. She's wearing this wig, this like very hyper blue eyeshadow. She has a chipped tooth that they purposely didn't fix, and there's a lot of close-ups on it, which I love. Like exactly what you're saying, Becky, cracked beauty. She's still beautiful, but it's like really Lynch commenting on scary beauty.
Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite little bits about Lynch is apparently when he met Isabella Rossellini for the first time, he said in his Lynchian sort of way, "You look a lot like Ingrid Bergman." And it was like, yeah, that's because it's her daughter, yeah. You idiot. Yes,
well, it's supposed to be Helen Mirren in this role and she never signed. So meeting Isabella Rossellini, which I believe was at a party or something like that, was really fateful. They also embarked on a 4 or 5 year romantic relationship that didn't end until the early 90s. Yeah, I can't picture anyone else in this film. That the accent, the physicalness of her body, it's so, she almost has like this 18th century body type that's so gorgeous. Like it's grotesque beauty. She's overly beautiful.
She plays it to excellent effect too in Death Becomes Her, as well as the picture of perfection. Right. Yes. one of the podcast favorites.
There's also a good story because he actually got very excited to meet her because she was working with Helen Mirren, and he's like, oh, you have to get me in, you have to get the script to Helen Mirren. And then a couple days later, she said she got a package with a little note that said, "It occurred to me that you might want to play this role." Like, he was kind of like, oh, sorry, I realized I was so excited about Helen Mirren I was rude to the actress I was talking to.
And then I believe he invited her to Bob's Big Boy to have like probably a table read.
I mean, that's his spot. Yeah. It's also worth saying when we're talking about this cracked beauty that part of the reason we're talking about these two films, and I think that part of the reason that they both have Dennis Hopper, is this kind of concept of the new American Gothic, which was very big in 1986. We talk about River's Edge. We talk about on other content, Something Wild, and they all kind of suit this concept that was percolating in a lot of academic circles, where essentially Reagan and the Reagan era had become so obsessed with this view of the 1950s as this ideal. It's really essentially to modernize it and make America great again. But in Reagan's era, the 50s were close enough that you could point to exactly the 50s. You know what was good? The 50s. We were prosperous.
Your parents' generation.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was like, but again, ignoring. So many of these movies are showing that you are ignoring this rot. And like you say, you're ignoring that you're talking about a very white specific thing, but Blue Velvet and what we're going to talk about, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, are saying that also, like, just under the surface of this kind of ideal conservative world is always depravity. Like, it's always there. The darkness is there, and it's almost more disturbing when it is whitewashed over with this kind of sheen of classical wonderfulness.
Reagan really thought this was a paradise, and it's up to Lynch to prove that it's more like Paradise Lost.
Alicia, you brought up the idea that this is very much about domestic violence, and it's written all over it. And I think that's one of the things too that people forget about. Like, they're looking to this like economic thing, but like how many women were abused in this system where they weren't able to work, they were now pulled out of factories, et cetera, et cetera. And the family unit and this idea of the nuclear family is not as ideal as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I was reading someone I always kind of come back to from Intro to Film 101, Laura Mulvey, and she's written about this film pretty extensively. You know, she looks at kind of the occipital triangle you have here, where if Kyle MacLachlan's character is the son, then Dorothy Valens' character, played by Isabella Rossellini, is the mother, and Frank is the, you know, hyper-terrifying father. And, you know, Kyle MacLachlan lusts after Dorothy Valens in a way that a son would lust after a mother, and then has to somehow displace the Frank Booth character to get there. But then it is very true. She brings up the, you know, this domestic violence where Dorothy Valens is horribly abused by Frank. Both there's, I think, at least two scenes of rape. And then also there's a psychosexualness of her needing to be hit by both Frank Booth and Kyle MacLachlan. Mm-hmm. This is not, like, I think prior to this, we were kind of like, this is a fun film. It's actually not.
No.
It's stunning, and I get something more from it every time I watch it. As I grow older and I'm no longer, you know, a naive teenager, the elements of sexual and domestic violence, I'm really shaken. And I've probably seen this film a dozen times. Doesn't matter. I get more and more shaken because I think it's really accurate, even though it's hyper-stylized and surreal. Every time she is hit, and I know with censors they were like, you can't actually show Frank Booth's hand or even Kyle MacLachlan's hand in contact with Isabella Rossellini's character, so you had to cut around it. That has since been restored in the kind of director's cut, if you will, that's come out recently. I think Janice put it out. It was pretty phenomenal in 4K. But this is a brutal film about just how terribly treated women are and how vulnerable they are under Reagan's paradise. And you even see that with kind of Kyle MacLachlan's mother and Laura Dern's mother, who, especially when Dorothy Valens arrives to the house naked, having been abused, Laura Dern's mother is useless, completely useless, doesn't understand what's happening. The way Kyle MacLachlan treats his own mother is, you know, very, she's just not an important character. Yeah. She doesn't have a voice.
I don't want to talk about it. Everything is okay now. I just don't want to talk about it.
Oh, but sometimes it's good to talk things over, Jeffrey. For instance, they say that many marriages are saved by people...
I love you, but you're gonna get it.
Yeah, there's I do think that actually it's something that I've come to appreciate, because obviously the first time you see this movie, you're just so, like, you're so obsessed with, like, the weird drive in the car with Frank Booth and things. But I think that there's something that is, like, a bit of a... This is also, I think, pretty early on in reconsidering melodrama as art.
There's Sirk in here for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I think that there's a lot of disturbing, he makes a lot of disturbing choices in the early stuff. Like, I think the stuff at the hospital with Kyle MacLachlan's father, who's had like a stroke or something, you don't really know. He's in horrible traction.
Heart attack or something.
Yeah. And all that stuff on the side, like you talk about, like, it seems like Laura Dern's mom is an alcoholic, probably. Mm-hmm. She's always sitting watching TV with, like, a Miller High Life, just kind of zoned out.
There's a lot of commentary on beer brands.
Oh, yeah.
In this film, I should say.
My God. But you still kind of want to go to that weird bar that they go to.
The slow, what's it called?
There's that one, and then also This Is It, the weird bar that's
Yeah,
but anyway, I like that stuff. Like, I think that there's a lot more to, and the fact that it opens and closes with the weird kind of fireman waving, and there's just, you see a lot of the stuff where I think he's saying that, like, even the stuff you consider normal, like, Laura Dern is actually catcalled a lot and kind of, like, harassed a lot.
By her home boyfriend at a certain point. She's going to beat up Kyle.
Oh, totally. And it's this stuff that you're like, oh, yeah, that's normal. But then you're like, when you're seeing all this other twisted stuff, you're like, none of this is normal.
I kind of think of it, you know, because I think Lynch had a very, he's so obsessed with American culture, but to me, especially during this period, has a very European sensibility to filmmaking. If you think about Buñuel or something like that, I see, especially having done The Elephant Man, which, you know, put him in an English mode of filmmaking. I think a lot of this is sort of how outsiders, and maybe as Canadians, we're kind of outsiders, view America. This, like, he's really hyper, making everything very hyper realistic, or, like, sorry, I shouldn't say realistic, hyper surreal, in a way that I think a European would smoke a cigarette and be like, fucking Americans. Like, that's sort of how Lynch is able, and it's incredible because he's such an all-American boy, like, based on how he grew up and where he's from and his father. And yeah, he just is able to, at a very young age, beginning with Eraserhead, subvert this kind of thing. It's actually incredible.
I think about this one. You can't look at this one and not think about Twin Peaks at the same time. And Twin Peaks was my first exposure to David Lynch. I hadn't seen any of his films, but
probably
I watched
the... Probably me too.
And it's such a... Sp- special series that I think if people haven't gone back and like actually watched the 90s series, they've just seen The Return, they really are missing out something really special and unusual. And what I think he does so well, and that very, very few people do, is that he makes you laugh and then he scares the shit out of you. And it's finding that, like, that balance. And I remember the first time I saw that image of Bob crawling over furniture trying to get towards Laura's mom.
It's in a European pilot, I believe.
It scared me so bad. I had nightmares forever. And thinking about, like, because it's that nightmare dreamscape. Mm-hmm. And you get that here as well with the same thing of how heightened and how violent that nitrous oxide attack becomes. Sure. I mean, everybody points to the car ride, which is also very surreal and very, like, you know, threatening. But yeah, for me, that attack is just so, it would be comical if it weren't so fucking scary.
I've presented David Lynch films theatrically for my series, I think several times, including Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me when The Return was debuting. Mm-hmm. And I really had a hard time with it because, of course, it was going to be a celebration. I want to say I'm like Twin Peaks number one fan. I've never been to one of the conventions. I'm also from Portland, Oregon, so it's like my region of the world. But, you know, I love it. But I also I feel very conflicted in the same way that I feel conflicted about Blue Velvet in the way that we're talking about, because if you look at Twin Peaks, the TV show, which was on ABC, which is killer to me, you know, the mm-hmm. station that had The Wonderful World of Walt Disney. Yeah. This is the whole impetus for the show is a 17-year-old girl has been raped and murdered. And then everything else that happens after that is funny. And Fire Walk With Me, I think, which people hated at the time and is now viewed as a masterpiece, really was Lynch saying, like, fuck you for getting so quirky and loving Twin Peaks so much without ever addressing the fact that this is about the sexual abuse and death of a minor, like multiple minors, in fact.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because it's like you look at David Lynch's relationship with women, specifically with a lot of his muses, is difficult and problematic when you mm-hmm. look at some of the history. Him and Isabella Rossellini had a very famous, very horrific falling out, which she had to go to her other former lover, Martin Scorsese, to try and work out. And Scorsese basically said to her, well, you knew this was coming. You knew what this was. And in the filming of Blue Velvet, there's this, of course, famous story about the scene where Isabella Rossellini is completely nude on a front lawn. And she's been assaulted. When they shot this film, they shot it outdoors in where they were filming in North Carolina in this small town. And people had set up to watch this film crew shooting with like picnic baskets, and they brought their kids and grandma, etc. And instead of clearing these people out, they shot with her anyway. And in her, the way Isabella Rossellini describes it, she's like, I dissociated from myself in that moment because I had to, which is, of course, a coping with abuse technique. And also famously, they then lost all of their filming rights in North Carolina after they did that film outdoors in front of all those people, or that scene outdoors in front of all those people. But that to me is like, oh, that's really irresponsible filmmaking. That's not a safe set. That's not what you should be doing here.
No, I will say that she does say that the set was generally very safe and good.
Okay. Thank you,
Cam. That's a one-time thing. Yeah. Because she says, like, I guess a lot of people say that David Lynch has a weirdly, like, very positive and good feeling set. Because he has, if you ever read Catching the Big Fish, his book, he's very, like, he's very into transcendental meditation. But one of his things is, like, stopping fear. And, he wants a set without any fear because he says you can get people to work with fear, but it's only, like, 1% of what you would get if
I'd
people
like
were
to think
not
Laura
afraid.
Dern, I'd like to think Laura Dern would never work with him again. If,
agreed.
Because she has such a, like... Mm-hmm. trusted relationship that at this point now spans 35 years. It's actually amazing.
Yeah, and I think that they don't credit that problem to Lynch as much as it was like ADs who didn't clear the people out.
Yeah, you're right. Wilmington was like, you are out of here.
Yeah, no more of this. I think the other thing we should bring up too is the relationship with Dino De Laurentiis, who was who produced this film and a number of other films, including the famous remake of King Kong, which I'm sure we'll get to on this podcast.
Like that
eventually.
I do too. But I think when Charles Grodin passed away last week, I spent most of my nights crying, but definitely rewatched King Kong, or I think I will soon. But he's great.
All
it's
I can
a great,
ever
it's a great film.
Think of is the impression by John Belushi where he goes, when my monkey die, everybody cry. Which is weird. It's weird that there was a producer famous enough that there was a Jim Belushi impression of him. But yeah, it's. I think I find this very interesting because Dino De Laurentiis also produced, and I think it's a great tip of the hat to these 80s producers that we talk about, because Dino De Laurentiis is kind of all over the place. He absolutely like revolutionized Italian film and distribution. He made Italy an international film power up there with France in a way that is amazing. But he also made a lot of garbage to allow him to do the other stuff. But it allowed him to do it to the point where he made Dune. And Dune was a massive failure, and I'm sure he lost a ton of money, but he was still happy to make Blue Velvet because Blue Velvet was like his art one, you know? And he had another King Kong movie. I think it's King Kong Lives is this year. So like you can see, if you look at his slate, it's like eight movies you may or may not have heard of. Obviously, he had Conan in this decade, so he was sitting like pretty.
Red Sonja is where Dino.
But I mean, they probably made enough money that he. Yeah. But yeah, if you look, his slate is usually like one movie where you're like, whoa, that what a great artistic achievement. And I think he had a much better batting average in that regard than Cannon, who tried to make art films, but mostly made like Godard's King Lear and stuff.
I can't get over Zeffirelli's opera. I can't get over Othello the opera with Placido Domingo in blackface. It's just, I'm sorry, that for me is now the pinnacle of what were you thinking?
Yeah, listen, it's the decade of Soul Man. Blackface was not yet out.
Oh boy.
I would say, like, we don't want to spoil the ending of Blue Velvet, but it's such a fantasy to me. Like, I don't think it's real, you know, and there's so much focus on this robin that has a little like bug in its beak, which you kind of referenced earlier, Becky. And there's so many questions online of, okay, was it a real robin, which Lynch claims it was? I can't imagine it is. No. Was it a puppet or was it both? Turns out it's both. He like somehow got a real robin, hopefully found it dead, taxidermied it, and then made it into a puppet. So it's so fucking surreal, that ending shot. And I feel like everything, even though everything gets wrapped up and like Kyle MacLachlan's character's dad is fine and he's still dating Laura Dern, even though he's been revealed to have a psychosexual relationship with Isabella Rossellini. Everything's fine. Nothing's fine. Nothing's fine in Reagan's America. Everything is fucked. Like,
and what I want to put in your head next time, viewers, is the part that always bothers me, and I the part where I almost want to freeze frame and get a magnifying glass is a person we will talk about again, Frances Bay, is standing at the window watching, a famous old lady actress, you'll know her, and she goes,
I don't see how they could do that. I could never eat a bug.
And then she immediately eats something crunchy. And I think there's supposed to be a bug on that piece of food that she doesn't notice. Like, that's like
I
a real Lynch.
Yeah,
but it's so hard to see. It's very small. Yeah. But I think that there's like a fly on the cookie she's eating when she says, I could never eat a bug. And I'm like, there's your thesis, Lynch. but because it's her, you're like, I'm delighted.
I guess. Well, she's now holding cream corn, right? So it's just, man, there's so many connections to Twin Peaks here.
Twin Peaks for,
It's that, and I mean, we haven't even talked about the soundtrack, which is Angelo Badalamenti and Julie Cruz, who, of course, would then do all of Twin Peaks. So, yeah, like, if you love Twin Peaks and you haven't seen Blue Velvet or vice versa, what are you doing with your life? What are you doing?
We didn't
Something
even
productive?
Mention Roy Orbison, but then again, we can't play the song because of race issues. Good Lord, MVP of Blue Velvet is
He didn't want it, but then he saw it and loved Blue Velvet, so he won him
it was
over.
Meant to be, it was meant to be crying and not in dreams, and then Lynch kind of reversed it the last minute, which is interesting.
Roy Orbison got it.
Which, can I just end this segment by saying, if people haven't heard Katie Lang's version of Cryin', stop what you're doing right now and go listen to it, because holy shit, it's great.
If I could tack onto that, if you haven't heard Angelo Badalamenti's torch lighting song from the 1992 Barcelona Olympics, be prepared to realize the 1992 Barcelona Olympics were briefly like Twin Peaks.
And can I add on that Lana Del Rey in 2012-13, I think, did a cover of Blue Velvet in a very Lynchian music video that Lynch was not involved with at all, but Lynch loved it. Lana Del Rey. Like, there's just, that is the perfect sort of vehicle for Lana Del Rey to subvert.
I think that's exactly where we have to end this. All right. When we come back, we're obviously talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. So grab your slickers. Let's get into some serious Tom Savini realness.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In 1974, director Toby Hooper set up a viewing in a small LA screening room for fellow Texan and screenwriter Kit Carson of a movie he'd just brought to Cannes. Kit brought along his buddy Paul Schrader, and they were forever changed by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The two stayed friends and hoped they'd be able to work together at some point in the future. A few attempts to work on projects fell through until 1984, when Kit's screenplay for Paris, Texas won the grand prize at Cannes. That's when two things happened. Kit's agent informed him that he was now part of a list of elite screenwriters, a list he realized he did not want to be on, and he would need to do something to get off as soon as possible. The second is that Toby Hooper had finally found a project they could work on together, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Two birds, one stone. Now, I haven't actually seen the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This is a big gap in my film history knowledge, and this is the only installment I will probably ever see. Alicia, I know, is in the same boat, but oh, yeah. Cam, you have seen at least the first four, five? How many of them are there?
There's four originals, and then the reboot, and then the reboots get tough because there's like a reboot prequel, a sequel reboot to the original film.
Is that the legendary film ones? I know it's changed, like,
yeah,
distributors and producers often.
It also
often
changes. Okay. Boy, oh boy. It's almost a Night of the Living Dead where I'm like, I know there are rights to it, but the rights seem real easy to buy. Because there's truly ones you've never heard of. There's two different movies just called Leatherface. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 is Leatherface, and then there's a recent one called Leatherface. The important thing to know, I think, that maybe has been lost with time is it's a fairly respected movie in its time. It also played at Cannes, which is kind of wild.
It was huge at Cannes.
Very respected in Europe. And so what is very innovative about it, what I don't know if you still to this day do, but when I was in film school, you watched it, is that it uses almost only diegetic sound. There is no soundtrack in the film, which really increases the terror and realism. So
yeah, for horror,
in many ways,
that's really rare.
Yeah, totally. And I think at the time, it really made people rethink horror. So in many ways, Toby Hooper is kind of an honorary member of New Hollywood because of when he was working and the verite style he used.
He was a documentary filmmaker, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's kind of from all sorts of walks of life. He had a famous movie before that you can't really find, and he admits is just a psychedelic nonsense garbage movie. But almost all the Texas Chainsaw Massacre people worked on it.
I do want to say that I would like to watch the first film. And I had planned to. There was a TIFF screening of, I think the program is called New American Gothic, probably programmed by Robin Citizen. I'll have to fact check that. But COVID hit, couldn't do it. Yeah. But I was geared up to see this film theatrically. I've made it, I think, bigger than it needs to be.
Yeah.
And I'm so scared of this film. but I love the second one. This is pure burlesque to me. I love it so much.
Yeah.
Including a lady lead, but we'll get into that.
Yes. Well, anyway, what we need to do to transition to the second one is essentially the first one is about this group of hippies who have trouble on the road. They meet a hitchhiker. The hitchhiker ends up being nefarious, and they end up being led into this nightmare house where there is, notably for this film, a cook who kills people and turns them into food to eat. They're cannibals. And an Ed Gein inspired killer, Leatherface, who is a giant kind of butcher who wears a face made of people's skin. For theory's sake, it's important to know that in this film, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, it doesn't happen, but Leatherface also frequently likes to wear women's skin and make himself look very pretty. He's considered a bit of a sometimes a pseudo trans red character, though at the time Gunnar Hansen, he wanted him to be like the Shape in Halloween. He considered him to just be a cipher, and when he put on skin, that was him putting on a mask. The film we see, Leatherface, is treated quite differently.
Is a film series, though, if I can ask, because I read the AV Club's run this series, which very, you know, quick blurbs about what each one is kind of about. And it seems like this is a film series that changes lore faster than any other series. Like Halloween's kind of but like this is like totally renaming what the family's named and like new characters pop up and you're just kind of expected to follow along.
There's almost nothing consistent. And even so, a part of the appeal of the first film is it pushes very hard that it's based on a true story, like Fargo or something. Okay. It's not at all. But the first film opens with like a series of Polaroids. This sound you might know from Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the sound of a Polaroid going off of this crime scene and people investigating a crime scene and like talking about the real murderers of the Texas Chainsaw, which this film opens with as well. So anyway, the whole point of this is this movie kind of already rewrites it. Kit Carson and Toby Hooper didn't really want to make a sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but they stumbled on an idea they liked, which was kind of this heightened parody, turning it into a weird parody of Reagan's America and Texan conservatism. So this film sees us on the weekend of the Red River Showdown football game, which is a huge game between Oklahoma University and the University of Texas Austin, where essentially all of Texas comes to town. They have chili cook-offs. As the cannibal cook says, this is the biggest weekend for meat in Texas. These two men are killed on the road, and you find out essentially that since the events of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre film, that these Texas is essentially in denial that there is a string of murders, that there are chainsaw-wielding murderers who are somehow traveling around Texas, continuing to kill people. And pretty much everyone is in denial, save Lefty, a lawman who is kind of shamed, who is the uncle of two of the characters who were killed in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1.
This I didn't get, so I'm glad you're...
Yes.
And this is Dennis Hopper.
Yes. So eventually you will see Franklin, who most people is more memorable, who is the guy in the wheelchair in the first movie.
We mean corpse, right?
Yes. Okay. But was a guy in the first film. He was an alive guy who got killed by Leatherface.
And for some reason they have transported his corpse with them to this underground lair. Okay, great.
Yeah. I mean, it's all kind of interesting iconography. I guess I'll start with the main character. The main character is Stretch.
Yes!
Stretch is a DJ at K-Okla, Burke Burnett, Texas radio station, just outside of Dallas-Fort Worth. And she is essentially harassed on the phone by these preppy Reagan era douches.
They look like creeps from Night of the Creeps.
They do! Good call. Mm-hmm.
And that was very much, I guess, Kit Carson and Hooper were like, well, he was killing hippies in the 70s. What would he kill now? And they're like, the cool guys at the Dallas Mall who you hate. And while they're, you know, sexually harassing her and just talking nonsense, you know, football bro kind of pregame nonsense, she overhears them being murdered.
With a chainsaw.
With a chainsaw.
Maybe that's obvious to listeners, but it wasn't obvious
It's a pretty great scene, actually. I think of the introducing you to how bloody and gory this film is going to be. Like, the guy gets like his head chopped immediately and it's like, you know, spurting blood and everything. And there's a great interview with Tom Savini, who did the special effects of this. And people who don't know Tom Savini, he is like considered the wizard of gore. His stuff is like always over the top, always grotesque. He appears in Dusk Till Dawn as like the weird codpiece vampire. Like, that's kind of his thing.
Who doesn't know Tom Savini?
Yeah. And people, I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast,
I mean, if you
probably
don't know horror.
Yes, but he was very disappointed because apparently a lot of the effects in this were even more gory, but they did not appear in the shots they used. So, for example, in that head being chopped open, there's actually all these packing peanuts covered in blood, so it looks like brains kind of like slipping out. It's a whole thing.
It's anyway, worth saying that this movie is extremely violent.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't have a stomach for that, as much as I think that this is a great film that everyone should watch, you can't watch it if skinning and goring.
I don't know. I don't have a stomach for it. And I can watch this because it's such a parody that I am, I guess, somehow distracted. Right. And the gore feels cartoonish to me, even though it's excellent gore. It looks very realistic.
I will say that there are a handful of things that I find incredibly stomach turning.
Now that I think about it, maybe
there's a lot of hitting heads with hammers. Yes. That's no fun.
That's bad.
Anyway, the plot, just to quickly get through it, it's Stretch ends up teaming up with Lefty, who has been chasing these chainsaw wielding murderers. Lefty pulls the kind of bad idea of using Stretch as bait for the family by getting her to replay this murder and essentially smoking out the family.
On her radio station.
On her radio station, which gets her and her producer, LG, embroiled in this this murder cult. But Stretch is a very active protagonist. She says she wants to do greater things than what she's doing, so she really wants to stop these guys. And when given the chance to escape, she does not escape. And her and Lefty essentially pursue them to their lair at Texas Battleland, a defunct amusement park.
Based on the Vietnam War, isn't it? Which is bizarre.
Based on all Texas battles.
Okay.
You can see Alamo Civil War guys. Anyway, so they end up confronting the family, and we see the most of the family. In the previous movies, the families were a bit of a cipher, but here you get to know Leatherface and the cook much deeper. You get many speeches from the cook. You get a new guy, Chop Top.
Love Chop Top. Bill Mosley.
Yeah, Bill Mosley. It steals the show and is the thing that I can barely watch, who loves picking his own scabs and eating them.
Yeah, that makes me want to vomit. No,
with a hot coat hanger. He heats up the coat hanger, scratches his head, and you're like,
it's horrible.
Yeah.
So this is Radio Land, huh? The infinite eternal, the waves through the ether fuzz roll on forever. Roar!
And they are joined by the corpse of the hitchhiker from the first film, who they now call Nubbins.
That's Nubbins.
Nubbins. Nubbins is the corpse thing that Bill Mosley likes to dance around with.
So Nubbins is separate from Franklin.
Yes, Franklin's the guy in the wheelchair.
The corpse.
Yes. The kind of one weird emotional, because it's worth saying Dennis Hopper is essentially playing like a weird John Wayne who's like twisted and religious and kind of bringing the religious fury down. And the one
with
kind
a
of
chainsaw.
With many chainsaws, three, I think. And he, the one time we kind of see him break is when he finds the body of Franklin.
His nephew.
And his nephew, who which reminds him what he's doing it all for.
Don't you cry, my brother. I'm here now. I'm here now. They can't do this. They can't do this.
And if you're a big Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 head, you know that the thing that was cut is Stretch is also his daughter.
Which is insane.
And she doesn't know it. Okay.
Yes. But he doesn't know it either. So that's also kind of an incredibly bleak Toby Hooper, Kit Carson thing, where I think that they were trying to say, guess what? This family's fucked up. Cannibal family's fucked up. Well, so is the regular family.
It's also a bit of a stretch, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah. I think for me, the idea that the cannibal family is actually extremely functional.
Yes.
They stay together. The family that kills together stays together.
Well, I think
the saw is
of,
family, which you know many people have tattooed on them.
Yes. A lot of people point to that they are meant to be the Reagan ideal. Because it's like they are the nuclear family, which stays together. I mean, there's weird things like it is, in the end, you find out, a matriarchal sort of thing. Because
grandma,
of god of them all is this grandma that's like upstairs in the weird chapel.
The shrine, she's dead, but
Or is she? That's the weird thing, too. Because she kind of moves.
You're breaking Grandma Alicia and right Grandpa, now, Cam.
There's also this long Texas Chainsaw Massacre thing that potentially they never really die because they consume human flesh. Because Grandpa is meant to be, in some iterations, like a Civil War guy. Here they make him an unemployed, due to mechanization, slaughterhouse worker.
Yeah, but, which I love. He's wearing a tie and everything. It's so funny. Like, yes. He's going out for a job interview that he's never going to get.
But Grandpa in the original film is also a disgusting thing where you think it's a corpse, but then he starts slurping up blood and kind of animated. Here, he's quite a bit more animated. But Grandma is barely animated, but then kind of looks around when she gets her arms torn off.
I might need to rewind. I'm not going to. I'll just take your
I will say the I'm reason sure I am so with this movie is my friend, filmmaker and horror writer, Craig Stewart, watches it every year for his birthday, so I've probably seen this a dozen times.
You are the reason I saw this. I would have normally, when we were writing and researching 1986, I was like, absolutely not, Cam. No way in hell. But you really did convince me that this is very me, which I found upsetting, and then understood after watching it. Still unclear why it's me, but I do really want to thank you for bringing Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 into my life.
It's a thing that no one would think to watch. I will say we are proudly, hopefully, hosting it for Halloween on Hollywood Suite.
Yes.
And alone, because I think it can stand alone as its own film.
Oh, yeah, no question.
What I learned with rewatches and with Craig, who loves film theory and horror theory, is that this film, it was a fine enough hit, and I think big on horror. Heads, because it's full of gore, it's full of these great performances. Carolyn Williams is great, Bill Moseley is great, as we say, but it's a film that was really rehabilitated in the 90s and 2000s by theorists, because you've got Carol Clover, who really
feminist
critic, who talked about essentially Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 and talking about kind of the feminist reading Chainsaw as penis, you know, what you would think. But then Jack Halberstrom, publishing at the time under the name Judith, has a book called Skin Flicks, if you're looking it up. It is about kind of, various feminist queer readings, and really does a big thing that we'll talk about on our show. With the same problem happened with Friday the 13th, where this film was read as incredibly misogynist, partially because you have the chainsaw penis waving around and very explicitly a penis.
Between Carolyn Williams's legs, basically.
Yes. But what Jack Halberstam points out is that, like, you're denying female viewership when you consider it misogynist, because, like, it's a very active woman character. They also point out it's a very active butch together woman who is not, you know, not very feminine and is just manipulating. The thing is, from the minute she realizes that this is a sexual thing for Leatherface, she is manipulating him.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, Carolyn Williams says, like, you know, this is a love story. This is about
so bonkers
two people
to me.
Who actually like each other. Like, she comes to trust Leatherface, and she is not in the fight with Leatherface, because Leatherface is pretty much on her side, which is kind of wild.
Okay, what? Are you pissed off? What about me? Listen, this is not going to work out. I'm trying to be open with you. It's nobody's fault. I just can't do this.
She's also kind of, I don't want to say sexually harassed by her coworker, and I really love the character of LG. But, you know, he's constantly asking her out, and she has to kind of put him off. And you get the sense that this has been going on for years. And she really is like, that relationship is to me actually a very feminist relationship. And he's a very surprising character who ends up saving her, but not in a way that she would ever be like the damsel in distress. By wearing his face, she is able to.
And this is, I think, going back to what I enjoy in this film is it's a surprisingly rich text. Like, you can kind of rewatch it from X or Y angle and enjoy it. And I think that part of that is because Tobe Hooper and Kit Carson were they felt a big weight as, at the time, two of the most prominent filmmakers of Texas. Yeah. And this is a very Texas production. This is like a lot of the stuff you find very interesting is because of like the cinematographer is this guy, Richard Couras, who is just the cinematographer in Austin. He was kind of like the big guy and they wanted him for Texas Chainsaw 1 and didn't get him. So he came back, but like the cinematography is wild. It's all very well considered. So when you're talking about like LG and Stretch, that's kind of this fascinating dynamic because you have these two Texas actors who like know this dynamic between men and women and like what that is like. Is it bad? Is it good? And you kind of don't know, but she has this great affection for this guy who kind of obviously is always asking her for a date.
And he's like 20 years older than her.
And he's 20 years older than her. And he's kind of a good old boy, but he's also kind of sweet. And you're like, maybe could they be a good couple? I don't know.
Hard ass.
Hard ass? Me? Maybe a semi-hard ass, but I got a soft heart.
You do feel bad when he dies. Like, that is one of the things that I think this film does really well, is that when he dies, the way he dies, twice, technically.
Is it because he's not wearing any skin?
Yeah. Oh, no, and I mean, he is heartbreaking. And it's fascinating because Lou Perryman was just a crew member on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1, but he's just so good.
He also became like a staple for Toby Hooper. Like he's in Poltergeist. He's in a few other things, right?
Yeah.
He, interesting for true crime people, he was murdered. He was murdered in his own home by an axe by someone who had gone off their medication. Really horrific and horrible.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying, Cam. And I think, the weight of, as Texas filmmakers, as Texas crew, like what this means. It's interesting to me because I was reading a piece on this about how probably the closest like companion this particular film has is Gremlins 2.
Sure.
It's almost like, because there's so much expectations for Gremlins 2 and it's very much a burlesque of Gremlins 1. Like it's just totally satirizing the ridiculousness of the first film. It's really like filmmakers nuking the franchise from orbit. Didn't work. It actually did work in Gremlins, except we do have critters and ghoulies that take over. But It didn't work for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, maybe much to Toby Hooper's dismay. And he's never involved again, right? In another.
No,
he gets producer credits and
producer,
creator credits.
He created,
but that's it.
Yeah. I mean, that's just token.
I think he doesn't want to be. The interesting thing is, I think it's weird because 2 didn't necessarily please horror people because it was
silly.
It was silly. And it doesn't necessarily please the average person because it's so violent. Like, I think he really ramped that up. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But it's interesting because it does very much affect the franchise. Because you see, like, Bill Moseley shows up in many of the reboots just as, like, a wink. And you see people caring a lot about the family members and making each member. For instance, the next one features Viggo Mortensen as Tex.
Who's
kind of a sexy. The fourth one features Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey.
That I knew. Yeah, that makes sense for Texas.
And
that
so, like, Matthew McConaughey has a robot leg brace in that one.
Maybe I need to watch these, actually.
They're pretty wild, but yeah, and like Arlie Ermey shows up as essentially the cook in the reboots. So there is this care, the way that they build out the family as this interesting unit, and each one has a purpose quite often in how they lure people into so like in the reboot, Arlie Ermey's a cop who's luring people, so he like fakes, oh, you gotta come into the station or whatever, and then they get chopped up by Leatherface. So I think that there's that, and the better reboots and sequels understand the little bit of humor.
Can I say that there's a line in this film, and it's not, I know we're focused on Dennis Hopper, and Dennis Hopper is unhinged. If you think he's unhinged in Blue Velvet, this is like
this is his most. I'm shocked in that David Letterman. He's not like, well, no, it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre
too. I don't know. He's pretty wild in River's Edge. Like, there's some other stuff going on there.
But there's him testing the chainsaws. I don't know.
There's a line. It's the cook. So Pa Sawyer gets a chainsaw in the butt. He's fine. He's just like minorly injured. And he says, why does the small businessman always get it in the ass? I can't remember. It's just like such a Reagan comment. Like, I love it so much.
And I mean, he is like Jim Sydow, the guy who plays cook, is so good. He's also like a very classic actor who's been
around
forever.
This is his last role. He never worked again after this. He doesn't die right away. He's quite elderly, but he didn't act again.
And he's the one main cast holdover from original Texas. So he plays the same character in both.
Got it.
But yeah, he is just endless. When they're like, what's your advice for great chili?
It's the meat. Don't skimp on the meat.
Someone spits out a tooth.
He just mumbles nonsense to himself. And I always love, like, people love the Saw His Family thing. But, like, his actual quote is, you have one choice, boy, sex or the Saw. Sex is, well, nobody knows, but the Saw is family. And that's, like, so good. He's such a, like, I mean, it's meant to be this kind of weird, twisted inbred, but he's, like, the great conservative where he's always talking about, I'm just trying to run a small business, and you jerks, monsters, always trying to. So he's like, you know, he's your QAnon
his
uncle.
Chili business.
Yes, exactly. His food truck, let's be honest, this is an Austin food truck before it's a mobile chili truck. So he was in on that. But yeah, this is, like I say, it's just for instance the set design is insane.
Yeah, and they built it in one month.
Yeah, hearing how they built it, it's crazy. And then the cinematographer being like, how the fuck do I light an underground tunnel when there's no electricity? And the answer is, get as many things from a junk shop as you can and just
there's
let
like
them down.
And
it looks great.
It's this great, like, it's interesting because you hear it sounded like it was hell. This set was a nightmare. It was hot. They talk about, like, it was an old printing factory where if people went up to the rafters, they came down covered in printer's ink to the point where they were just, like, in blackface. But everybody kind of loved it because I think everybody, it was a real let's put on a show. This is an incredibly short turnaround, too. I think it was less than a year between them they were writing it on set. There's a great Kit Carson thing where he said at one point an AD came up to me and said, Kit, stop writing that scene, we shot it. And he's like, oh. So it sounds like it was a crazy mess, but everybody was in on it to the point where, like, so you're saying that lighting, the guy was like, okay, well, they hoard lamps, and they're like, what? And it's like, yeah, these guys, I don't know, they live in a crazy junk pile of human bones, why don't they also hoard lamps? So there's like a beautiful sequence of, because they're like, there was like 100 yards of chase hallway they had to do.
Yeah.
And the fact that they built, like, I can't even remember, it's not Kit Carson or Toby Hooper that thought of Texas Battleland. It was just one of the like production designers or something. It's like, what if it's an old theme park? And so built an old theme park, like, and it's giant. There's like giant Paul Bunyans and stuff. And she ends up climbing this massive spire to and I mean, they talk about the bones, or the funny thing is they talk about how easy it is to get bones in Texas, but that also some of the bones were like so ripe that it was off-putting to smell the set.
Oh no. I do want to talk about, because I also appreciate the fact that, like, these guys consistently brought work back to Texas. They were like, this is where we come from. Like, they didn't, like, later, I believe for Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, they moved to California.
Oh, yes. And it's very obviously California. It's kind of sad.
But I like that they actually went local as well for the character of Stretch as well. And she has such a great audition story where when people tell these insane stories about how they auditioned for something and got it by being a maniac, I'm always like, good for you. Don't do that. Don't do that. Because I think there's more stories about people being maniacs and not getting it and being blacklisted, like Mickey Rourke in Sin City or Sean Young as Catwoman. Like, there's always like those things where it's like, oh no, this person, not so much. But her story is pretty great, where she was watching all these girls go into audition and they were like, thank you very much, as they left. You know, everything was very quiet. And she's like, this is a movie about screaming. Did people see the first one? So she took a run up from the back hall, ran into the room, pulled Kit and Toby off their chairs, piled the chairs in front of the doors, screaming her head off, and then started the scene. And I'm like, that's actually, this is the right movie for that. That's
she
okay.
is a badass horror icon. I love watching interviews with her, which she still gives up to this day about this film. Enthusiastic, fan participant, like, just, I love Carolyn Williams. I completely understand the respect that the community has for her, because she's really open and just like so willing to talk about this film and like positive, and I think she's just a beacon of light. I love her, and she looks great with a chainsaw too, not to spoil the ending of the film.
Which the other thing I really love is that I've seen clips of the first movie, and I know it ends with Leatherface like whipping his chainsaw around in the sun, and she gets that moment on top of the spire and she ends it, which I really like, and I love that shot. I think it's really great as she goes
I will say if you ever want also a great, wonderful kind of feminist, which you actually might be, there's a lot of gifts. I feel like 2020 has really brought out a lot of original Texas Chainsaw gifts, but the ending is wonderful because, yeah, Leatherface has cut his own leg and is freaking out, and the woman who escaped covered in blood in the back of a pickup truck just mockingly laughing at him as she drives away. So I feel like that laughing woman covered in blood has been a great gif for 2021.
I think that's exactly where we have to end this, driving away covered in blood, laughing at what we have seen behind us. All right, Cameron Maitland, thank you so much once again for your extensive knowledge of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and its franchise.
It's a fun franchise. Two is absolutely the pinnacle for me. One is a beautiful, well-respected film. But yeah, don't dig into the whole franchise. I got no problems with some of those Jessica Biel reboots, but four is, as much as you really want to see Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey, it's not a great film.
It's not fun. Okay.
It's fun. Okay. I mean, they're fun bad. It's a great sit down with your friends series.
Pour myself a glass of wine and wait to be amazed.
And maybe put on your hat to decide how you feel about like the trans reading of Leatherface. Mm-hmm,
yeah.
It gets problematic in some of them, and some of them you're like,
there
trans icon. Yes.
Yep. There we go. All right, Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much once again for knowing so much about David Lynch.
Thank you. I'm going to go warm up my veggie burrito for lunch because I have not eaten meat in a solid week as a result of this podcast.
Veggie, it's probably good for you. Give yourself a little bit of a
cleanse.
I love
meat. Don't get me wrong. It's just lately I've been a little bit off it for some reason.
Totally fair. All right. Are you guys ready to head to 1994?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Flintstones. So exciting.
Okay. Join us again next week for a real drag. That's two Toronto drag performers, Allison Chains and Champagne, will be joining us in the Outback as we look at the adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Muriel's Wedding. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.